This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for our state news roundup. This week, communities around the state saw their schools dealing with threats of violence, and in two high schools, officers fired shots at students who were wielding a weapon. Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. She's been following this story. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have about 10 Wisconsin schools getting some kind of threat or incident. Let's start in Waukesha and Oshkosh. Both their incidents led to police firing shots inside school buildings to stop threats. Can you tell us what we know the latest on those two incidents?
Yeah, so the first was in Waukesha, and what happened there was a student brought two pellet guns to school, brought them into a classroom, and wouldn't drop them when a school resource officer approached him. And that led to more police, in the classroom, and one of them shot the student, I believe, in the leg and maybe in the arm. They were not fatal shots, and the student was in the hospital, and I believe he's going to be okay. But the police officer that shot that student did that in front of other students inside the classroom. So, talking to some students there was a lot of, it wasn't a school shooting in the way that we think of them, but it still was a gunshot being fired at a student inside of school. So obviously there was a lot of terror, within those hallways that day.
So that's Waukesha, and then Oshkosh, of course, we've had our eyes on.
Right. That was the next day, actually, and it was pretty much the same situation. There was a student who brought a knife to school. He got into a disagreement with the school resource officer, stabbed the officer, and at that point the officer fired a shot at him too. So I talked to one student who was in her math class when that happened, and she described a lot of just confusion and not knowing what's going on. You hear a gunshot inside of a school and your mind goes to the worst place. So there was she described a lot of students running out of the school, screaming, crying, things like that.
Yeah, and in your reporting, you talk about that with these and the other threats that came up this week, while thankfully they weren't that worst case, as you said, of an active shooting situation, it's on everybody's mind. And it sounds like that's a common theme when you talk to people at a lot of these different schools that had whatever version of this incident.
Right, yeah. I mean, there was, I think within 2 or 3 days, there were at least 8 high schools where the students there were either, kept home, something happened like in Waukesha or Oshkosh, or parents were told that something might happen. And I think, everybody's just on edge. Maybe these kinds of threats were happening, years ago, but we're just, with social media and the internet, they just, get farther. And I think because of the prevalence of school shootings these days, it's got everybody pretty freaked out.
I want to look at a couple of the other incidents over the course of the week. This one in Madison, I believe a middle school was involved where someone was actually shot with a pellet gun by another student.
Right. Yeah. So there was a, I think he was 13-year-old boy who had a pellet gun on a bus. And when he and other students were, arriving at maybe a bus stop after school, he shot a pellet gun out of the window at another student and hit her. Then the next day, I think one of his friends, also 13, brought that gun, or police believe it was that gun, to school. And that was at Jefferson Middle School in Madison.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel about incidents in Wisconsin schools this week, two police-involved shootings, some other threats. Can you talk, Molly, about what we saw when it came to social media threats against schools?
Yeah, so I talked to one police chief who said that, kids are making threats on social media or saying things on social media that might be perceived as threats. He said there's a lot of that going on, and he compared it to, saying I have a bomb in a TSA line at the airport. You just can't say things like that. And he said he's pretty frustrated with it, and he doesn't really know how to get that to stop, or to, educate children on, what they say on the internet in a public forum, and when people see things like somebody saying, you know, Waukesha North is next or whatever we saw this week, you know, that people will take that seriously and it will stir up a lot of fear in a community.
What kind of things have we heard from the governor and leaders in the state legislature in reaction to the events this week?
The governor has been pretty vocal about these incidents. What the Oshkosh incident actually happened at the high school where his children went to school. So he said that's something that's pretty close to him. And obviously he used to be a school superintendent and teacher. So incidents at schools are something that I think he has on his mind quite a bit. The lawmakers here, they basically were saying, you know, this is terrible, but we're happy that the drills and the resource officers, you know, the reason that we have resource officers in schools, you know, they did their job and it worked to keep people safe.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked to us about this week's threats of violence at 8 Wisconsin high schools and shootings at another 2. Coming up, we'll continue our state news roundup with a look at the debate over expanding ATV access on Platteville's city streets. Stay with us here on Central Time. We continue our state news roundup going now to Platteville, where the city council is debating whether to allow all-terrain and utility vehicles on more of their city streets. Steve Prestigard is the editor of the Platteville Journal. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, and on Wisconsin.
Can you tell us about this ATV and UTV proposal that's in front of Platteville's Common Council?
Yeah, to provide a little background, after spending nearly the entire summer last year debating this, the City Council approved 3 or 4 streets, all of them main streets in Platteville, for ATV and UTV use last year. There were no major problems, and the proponents of this wanted to expand the routes. There were a couple people on the council who thought that it should be allowed; they should be allowed on all city streets, and there were a couple others who thought maybe that's not a good idea, but they could be on more streets. And so that's where it's sitting right now. The council is going to discuss the expanded map in December, possibly vote on it in January, barring something happening.
Let's talk about the use of these ATVs. When I think ATVs in Wisconsin, one thing I think of is, farmers using them for work. I guess that's not what's happening in downtown Platteville. So who is it? Is this tourists? Is this locals? A little bit of both?
Yeah, actually, there are a few farmers that, you know, use them instead of a pickup truck. Uh-huh. But for the most part, there's two parts of this area that are big in UTV use. One is Lafayette County. And the other is kind of the southern and western ends of Grant County. And until they were legalized in town, if you wanted to go from one part to the other, you couldn't really do that. You had to go all the way around and go several miles out of the way. And you didn't have access to any kind of business, you know, a gas station, restaurant, bar, anything like that. So that was one of the reasons that proponents wanted to do this was to take advantage of the tourism possibilities, because certainly ATV and UTV use is growing considerably. And there are people here in Platteville who own UTVs and wanted to be able to at least drive onto the trails without having to throw them onto their onto trailers and, you know, truck them a couple of miles out of town in order to use the trails.
And what if critics of the, the initial decision to allow ATVs and then this idea to expand them, what are critics saying about all this?
Well, actually, the arguments have been the same from last year to this year. There is a claim that they are unsafe. You hear a lot of people saying that, even though there were, in the 10 months, there were no incidents involving, you know, UTVs hitting cars or trucks, or in a lot of cases, fear of pedestrians or bicyclists, that has not happened. There's also been claims that they are too loud. Those are the two basic ones. There's also been some skepticism that wasn't necessarily the case because nobody knew this last year, but business owners downtown on the UTV routes apparently really didn't see very much in terms of additional business I would argue that that has something to do with the fact that it was a horrible summer last year, as far as it rained all the time. We had flooding and all that. And, you know, as it is, 10 months is probably not a really good, a sufficient amount of time to be able to tell one way or another if it leads to more tourism and more business spending or not.
Steve, as we wrap up, this might sound like a small thing if you're not in the Platteville area, but sometimes in local governments, battle lines can be drawn over what might start off as a small debate. Has that kind of happened here?
Oh, I absolutely believe that that's the case. On the anti side, for some reason, there seems to be a lot of people that are connected to UW-Platteville, but there are also many, I think, longstanding residents who, I guess, seem to think that they're going to, you know, disturb the peace and all that, even though, again, that hasn't been the case. And on the other hand, you've got the owners, obviously, and you have people who feel like they can take advantage of additional business by having more people coming into town. So it's not partisan. I don't think it's ideological, but yeah, there are absolutely battle lines. And it's really, to me, kind of a microcosm of what feels like every political battle going on right now, partisan or not, ideological or not.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to do that, and on Wisconsin.
Steve Prestegard is the editor of the Platteville Journal. He joined us to talk about a proposal there to allow more ATV use on city streets. Now we head to Wausau, where reports of a snowball ban in the city showed up in some national media this week, causing people to say the city hates fun. But yesterday, Wausau's mayor and deputy police chief said that's not the case. Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter. He's based in Wausau. Hey, Rob.
Hey, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to set the record straight here.
Yeah, where did this fuss in the national media start about this Wausau snowball ban, so-called?
So indeed, Wausau does have a city ordinance that says you can't throw snowballs on public property. That is it is actually literally illegal to have a snowball fight in a park in the city, and you could theoretically get a ticket and a $114 fine for it. So that does exist. That's on the books, but it's like one of these sort of odd or anachronistic rules in the municipal code, and it's never actually enforced. Every so often, it'll show up on a list of like a dumb laws or whatever that go around. And every so often, someone decides to do a story about it. So that is what happened. A local TV station did one of these stories, and it was fine. It was a little explainer on this ordinance. But then that got picked up, and then that got picked up from other outlets who did not do their own reporting. And it was in the New York Post, and it was on a couple of very dumb websites who wrongly said this is a new ordinance, and Wausau is doing away with fun.
Well, this whole thing snowballed, and now Wausau's deputy police chief and mayor made this video yesterday to clear it up, complete with officers throwing snowballs at each other in the background. Here's a listen to Deputy Chief Matt Barnes explaining, and then beaning Mayor Robert Milkey with a snowball.
A fun snowball fight is a fun snowball fight, and that's not something we enforce this ordinance with. On the other hand, throwing snowballs at people that may not want it, that one got away from me.
You got him right in the side of the head there for people who haven't seen the video. As I understand it, they say they've only enforced the snowball part of this thing because, you know, this ordinance also includes like throwing rocks at people or, you know, rocks at property. They've enforced the snowball part of this twice for people who are throwing snowballs at passing cars. So that's a little different.
Right. I believe that's twice in 15 years or something. Yeah. So the video is worth a watch. The mayor really, really takes it. I think it was, it's quite clear that, that the deputy chief did not quite intend that exact throw. And it's a good piece of video.
Now, the key takeaway here, Rob, is that, and you are, I think, a witness to this in Wausau. We were just in a park, you and I in Wausau, in the snow the other day. No snowballs were thrown, but there are not squads of Wausau PD officers hauling kids out of city parks for the crime of throwing a snowball.
That's right. Thank you. Yes, thank you. It's important that people know this. The WPR audience should be aware that this is not a snowball-free zone.
And should we have a WPR Bureau versus Bureau snowball fight someday?
I mean, if you want to get destroyed, yeah.
I would worry about a Superior. I mean, they've had a lot of practice this year, I think.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And Danny Kading is tough.
Yeah. Rob, thank you so much for clearing this up for us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Rob Metzer, WPR's Rural Communities reporter. He's based in Wausau, and he talked to us about the city's response to national reports saying that it had banned the throwing of snowballs. He finishes up our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. If you were looking at a fake dinosaur bone in a field museum, would you be able to tell it was fake? Would it matter if it was? How about a supposedly rare gemstone in a jewelry exhibition? What if it looked legit, but it turned out to be person-made or made with glass? We're surrounded sometimes by fakes, sometimes really, really good ones. Sometimes things that are proven to be fakes turn into collector's items themselves. In her new book, our next guest asks why people value the authenticity or sometimes inauthenticity of material items from diamonds to artwork to fossils. Lydia Pine is a historian and currently visiting researcher at the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Her new book is called Genuine Fakes: How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
What led you to want to pursue this kind of weird realm of artifacts, the fakes, the genuine fakes?
Right. And so I was really interested in exploring this idea of authenticity and realness and naturalness and all of these things that sort of go into making these objects what they are, and especially sort of the question of the value judgments that we pass on these objects. And so I really wanted to work on a project that would be basically a biography of authenticity told through a series of objects. And so to that end, I tried to find objects to explore that were curious and complicated and really piqued my interest.
You start off with one example, Andy Warhol works. Somebody, after he passed away, an artist took some of his screen printing things, some with paint still on them, as I understand it, screen printed them and said, hey, I'm doing this. Andy Warhol didn't do these. And then that raised the question, well, are these Andy Warhol artworks?
Right. So the story of the Andy Warhol, or sort of the post-Warhol Warhols, is really fascinating. And so Warhol, as a painter, has a great legacy. He dies in 1987. But the artist Paul Stevenson in 2010 bought several of Warhol's acetates, the silkscreening prints that, as you point out, they have paint on them. They're the real thing. They're really what Warhol used. And Stevenson begins making new Warhol prints and sort of asks this question of, you know, Warhol had this incredible, the studio and this help and these assistants, and Warhol did in some ways very, very little in the actual construction of the silk screening. And so Stevenson's question is, well, what if we don't maybe perhaps need Warhol himself? Could we continue sort of in the spirit of Warhol? Could we continue in the legacy of Warhol? And again, I mean, Stevenson is very clear that he's not trying to pull a fast one or to sort of, you know, trick anybody, but is sort of pushing this question of what is it that we value about the singularity of a piece of art that leads us to ponder whether or not we could have new, authentic, quote-unquote, Warhols.
Now, when I think of fakes and forgeries, I usually assume that they're made by somebody who's trying to make money off of it. And you write in your book, that's often the case. But there's this one kind of sad story of this guy. He's trying to do archaeology. He's trying to find artifacts. And people litter a hillside with kind of crude, handcrafted fossils. Why do they do that?
Right. So the story, Beringer's Lying Stones, I'm so excited you wanted to talk about that because that's one of my favorite stories in the book. So in 1725, Johann Beringer was a naturalist. He was a professor at the University of Würzburg, and by all historical accounts was truly an insufferable human being. And so his colleagues decided, like, haha, we're going to sort of, you know, pull a trick on him and it's going to be great. He's going to find these fossils and he's going to look very foolish when he buys them up as the real thing, you know, sort of buys into this story of them. And Beringer does. He sort of falls for it hook, line, and sinker, even though I mean, looking at these carvings, as you point out, they're really not that great. I mean, even by any standard, they're just really hard to understand sort of how you could buy into the story. But he does. And so Beringer publishes about these fossils. He is very excited about them until eventually it's revealed that they are hoaxy, that they're not real, they're not natural, they're not anything except sort of this cruel practical joke. So Beringer turns around and promptly sues his colleagues for besmirching his good name, and they sort of slink off to the pages of history. And what one of the things that I think is so interesting about this story is that Beringer, you know, immediately tries to sort of destroy all evidence that he was ever associated with, you know, falling for this prank or this hoax. But several of these quote-unquote lying stones, these faux fossils, by the 21st century make their way into museums. And so you can actually go see these museum pieces in museums like Oxford University's Museum of Natural History has a couple. They're sort of scattered throughout the world. And the twist that I love with this story is we started with these fake fossils, and now they've become real artifacts. They're not, you know, they're certainly not going to tell us anything about evolution or, you know, the other things that fossils generally tell us about. But they tell us a lot about sort of the culture of 1725 and the story of Johann Beringer. And I like that transition from fakery to realness.
And that's not the only example. You give the story of the Spanish forger. We won't have time to go into that, but that's another case where fakes end up showing up at auction houses where people know they're fakes. Somehow they accumulate this story, this residue of their own history that makes them important artifacts of their own.
They sort of have this cachet almost, and the sort of sauciness or the backstory of that really carries the artifact through. It sort of adds to its the cultural history of the thing, sort of adding to its value there.
I want to flip it around now. You tell a story of an artifact that went the other way, where pretty much everyone, not quite everyone, but almost everyone assumed it was a fake. This Maya Codex, this book called the Grolier or Grolier, how do you say that?
The Grolier Codex, yes, yeah. Exactly. And this was a story that I wanted to talk through in Genuine Fakes because I felt like it really sort of flipped the story of what we mean when we talk about authenticity. So as you say, the Grolier Codex, when it was discovered in the 70s, everyone pretty much assumed that it was fake, that its provenance was kind of hokey. It was really problematic. There are so few codices that it just the odds of something like this being discovered were so slim that it sort of must be a fake. So the logic went. Eventually, in the 21st century, it is authenticated. It is a real artifact. It is an authentic artifact. And again, I like the story because it illustrates the idea that authenticity is a continuum. And so we can see artifacts sort of being debunked along that continuum, like the Spanish forger or Beringer's lying stones. But we can also see artifacts sort of moving sliding to the other side and becoming authentic over time, becoming real over time.
Talking to Lydia Pine about her new book, Genuine Fakes, How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. You also tell the story of one a practice that's not intentionally deceptive, the effort to create synthetic diamonds, ultimately successful. The story itself is fascinating, but we end up at this point where we have things that, to my eye, are going to look like diamonds. They weren't dug up from the ground. So how does the diamond industry react to that?
Right. So we have this case of laboratory grown diamonds where chemically, materially, they're identical to what, you know, get mined out of the earth. They're just not natural. They're laboratory grown. And I like this story because I feel like it's such a good example of sort of the cultural context that surrounds how we think about authenticity. And so when laboratory grown diamonds were first put out in the 1950s, the diamond industry sort of made this huge point of saying, look, these are not real. These are not natural. These are just these sort of fakey things that, you know, you go into your laboratory and wave your science wand and poof, we have diamonds. And, you know, what kind of person would really put that in an engagement ring? I mean, there's this sort of cultural baggage that comes with it. But in the 21st century, we start seeing this shift in cultural attitude about that, where suddenly something like a laboratory-grown diamond offers a alternative for consumers who are not interested in a gemstone that might possibly be associated with conflict diamonds or the environmental impact of mining. And so it sort of offers a different alternative for a different set of ethics. And again, it sort of illustrates this idea that authenticity is tied incredibly closely to its cultural, historical, and social contexts.
Now, I'm not a diamond guy, I'll say, but if I had a diamond ring and it was synthetic diamond, like, I couldn't look at it. I couldn't tell it by looking at it. Nobody could, I think, without some kind of special, I don't know, what, lighting gear or mass spectrometers or something. So what does it say about us that the diamond we made means something different than the diamond that was dug deep under, I don't know, South Africa?
Right. I think that that's a really fascinating question. And it really gets at this idea that the provenance or the provenience of something matters. And I think that the story of these laboratory grown diamonds really challenges that and says, well, we've thought that for decades now, but does it really? Could we embrace this sort of different origin as, you know, offering a different sense of what authenticity could mean? And I think that we're going to see parallel stories when we see things like plant-based meats or fake furs or all of these other things that are really sort of offering alternative materials to the quote-unquote natural or the quote-unquote original. That I think that it's this real re-examination of authenticity.
Now, you end the book with a quote that may or may not be from a Roman writer, Petronius. The quote is, anyway, whether he wrote it or not, "The world wishes to be deceived, so let it be deceived." So are we as, I don't know what, consumers, scholars, people, whatever, kind of complicit in being deceived by some of these fakes?
That's a great question, actually. And I love the sort of meta irony of this quote of, you know, here it is, the world wants to be deceived, so let it be deceived. And we can't quite trace the sort of context or the author of this quote. But sort of the, are we complacent in it, I think is a really interesting question. And I think that one of the themes that I have found to be true sort of as I've unpacked all of these different stories and these different objects for the book, the thing that I found to be really true is an understanding that context matters. And as long as people, whether it's consumers or manufacturers or whatever, understand and are transparent about those contexts, no one leaves feeling tricked or faked or defrauded. And that feeling, I think, is something that really underscores how we engage with authenticity as a concept.
In our last few moments, writing this book, did researching this book change the way you look at stuff, possessions, things you see at museums?
It did, actually. Some days it felt a little nihilistic, like, what's real anyway? But certainly it changes how I think about things. And one of the big takeaways is it changed how I used fake, the word fake, that I'm not so quick now to use it as a label or a moral judgment or a quick way to dismiss something. But I want it to have sort of a staying power that I think is easy to overlook.
Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Lydia Pine is a writer and historian who's interested in the history of science and material culture. She's a visiting researcher now at the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her latest book, it's a real book. It's called Genuine Fakes: How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff.